This was a paper, Reynolds News and Sunday Citizen, to give its full title, which had fallen on hard times, relaunched itself as a tabloid Sunday, and then finally closed. Presumably not long before this conversation. "I don't think it matters much," I said. I didn't really have any view on the matter. I might have seen a copy or two of Reynolds News, but was mainly just reacting to Morris's tone of deep concern. "You don't?" he asked civilly. "No, not really." "What about the diversity of the press? Isn't that something to be valued?" "All the papers seem much the same to me, so I don't see that one fewer of them matters much." "Are you by any chance part of the revolutionary left?" I laughed at him, not at his words, but at him. What the fuck did he take me for? Or perhaps who the fuck? He might as well have been a member of the tennis club committee back at the village. "No, I despise politics," I said.
"You despise politics? Do you think that's an entirely healthy attitude? Do you find cynicism a comfortable position? What would you replace them with? You'd close down newspapers. You'd close down our way of doing politics. You'd close down democracy. That sounds like a revolutionary left position to me."
Now, the fellow was really annoying me. I wasn't out of my area of competence so much as my area of interest. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's really not that at all. But, you see," I added, looking at him with melancholy seriousness, "it's just that I'm a member of a played-out generation. You may think we're a bit young for it, but even so, we're played out." He left shortly afterwards.
"Oh, Casey Paul, you are one wicked person."
"Me?"
"You.
Didn't you hear him say he'd worked for Reynolds News?"
"No."
"I thought he was a spy."
"You mean a Rusky?"
"No. I just mean he was sent along to check up on us and report back."
"Probably."
"Do you think we should worry about that?"
"Not for a couple of days at least, I'd say."
"You decide that, since you're a student, and all your fellow students, apart from those who live at home, pay rent, then you should do so too. You ask a couple of friends how much they pay. You take the midpoint, £4 a week. You can afford this out of your state grant. One Monday evening, you hand Susan £4 notes.
"What's that?"
she asks. "I've decided I should pay you rent," you reply, perhaps a little stiffly. "That's about what the others pay." She throws the notes back at you. They don't hit your face as they might do in a film. They just lie on the floor between you. Awkward silences follow, and you sleep on your sofa bed that night. You feel guilty about not having introduced the subject of rent with more subtlety. It was like when you gave her that parsnip. The four green pound notes lie on the floor all night. The next morning, you pick them up and put them back in your wallet. The subject is never mentioned again. As a result of Martha's visit, two things happened. The attic rooms were let out to lodgers, and Susan went back to the village for the first time since we ran away together. She said it would be necessary and practical to return from time to time. Half of the house belonged to her, and she could hardly rely on MacLeod to pay the bills or remember to get the boiler serviced. I didn't see why not, but still. Mrs. Dyer would continue to serve and thieve on a daily basis and would alert Susan to anything that needed her attention. She promised that she would only go back when MacLeod wasn't there. Grudgingly, I agreed. I said a bit ago that this is how I would remember it all if I could, but I can't. There's some stuff I left out, stuff I can't put off any longer. Where to start? In the book room, as they called it, downstairs at the MacLeods. It was late, and I was unwilling to go home. Susan might already have been in bed, I don't remember. Nor do I remember what book I was reading, something I'd picked off the shelves at random, no doubt. I was still trying to get my head round the MacLeod collection. There were leather-bound sets of the classics, old enough to have been handed down through maybe two generations. Art monographs, poetry, a lot of history, some biography, novels, thrillers. I came from the sort of household where books, as if to confirm that they should be respected, were put in order. By subject, author, even size. Here, there was a different system. or rather, as far as I could see, no system at all. Herodotus was next to the Bab Ballads, a three-volume history of the Crusades next to Jane Austen. T.E. Lawrence sandwiched between Hemingway and a Charles Atlas manual of bodybuilding. Was it all an elaborate joke? Mere bohemian muddle, or a way of saying, we control the books, they don't control us. I was still musing when the door banged back against the bookcase, then rebounded far enough to be kicked again. MacLeod stood there in his dressing gown, which, and this I do remember, was plaid, with a maroon cord tied and dangling. Below were his elephant pyjamas and leather slippers.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked, in a tone of voice normally attached to the words, "fuck off." My default position of insolence kicked in. "Reading," I replied, waving the book in his direction. He stomped across and ripped it from my hand, briefly inspected it, and then threw it like a frisbee across the room. I couldn't help grinning. He thought he was chucking my book away, when it was one of his own. Hilarious. That was when he hit me. Or rather, aimed a succession of blows. Three, I'm pretty sure. One of which landed as a wrist slapping the side of my head. The other two flailed past. I got up and tried to hit him back. I think I aimed one blow, which skidded off his shoulder. Neither of us was doing any snappy defensive work. We were just equally incompetent attackers. Well, I'd never hit anyone before. He, I assume, had, or had at least tried to. While he was concentrating on what to say or where to hit next, I squirmed past him, ran to the back door, and escaped. I was relieved to get back to a house where I hadn't been assaulted since a few doubtless merited spankings a decade and more previously. No, that wasn't quite true, about never having hit someone. In my first year at school, the gym master had encouraged us all to enter the annual boxing competition, which was organized by weight and age. I had absolutely no desire to inflict or receive pain, but I noticed that, with only a few hours to go, there were no entrants listed under my category, so I gave my name in, expecting to win by walkover. Unfortunately for me, for both of us, another boy, Bates, had the same idea at almost the same time. So we found ourselves in the ring together. Two skinny, scared things in plimsolls, vests and house shorts, with these big, bobbly gloves suddenly at the end of our arms. For a couple of minutes, we each did a reasonably good job of feinting attacks and then backpedaling at great speed, until the gym master pointed out that neither of us had yet landed a blow.
"Box!"
he had commanded. Whereupon I leapt at the unprepared Bates, whose gloves were down near his knees, and punched him on the nose. He squealed, looked at the sudden blood on his clean white vest, and burst into tears. And so I became school boxing champion in the under-12 and under-6 stone category. Naturally, I never fought again. The next time I went to the MacLeod house, Susan's husband couldn't have been friendlier. Perhaps that was when he showed me how to do the crossword, making it some kind of exclusive male preserve. Or at any rate, a Susan-excluding one. So I put the bookroom incident down as an aberration. And anyway, it might have been partly my fault. Perhaps I should have engaged him about which version of the Dewey system his library was organized under. No, I can see that might have been equally provoking. How much time then went by? Let's call it 6 months. Again, it was late-ish. At the MacLeod house, unlike my own, there was a main staircase near the front door and a narrower one near the kitchen, presumably for those mob-capped servants now replaced by machines. Often, when I visited Susan during term time, I would sleep in a small attic room which could be reached from either direction. Susan and I had been listening to the gramophone, preparing for a concert, and the music was still in my head when I reached the top of the back stairs. All of a sudden, there came a kind of roar, and something which might have been a kick or a trip, accompanied by a thump on the shoulder, and I found myself falling back down the stairs. I managed somehow to grab the banister, wrenching my shoulder, but just about keeping my balance.
"You fucking bastard!"
I said automatically.
"Watsky!"
came an answering bellow from above.
"Watsky, my fine and feathered friend!"
I looked up at the squat bully glaring down at me from the semi-darkness. I thought that MacLeod must be absolutely, certifiably mad. We stared at one another for a few seconds. Then the dressing-gowned figure stomped away, and I heard a distant door close. It wasn't MacLeod's fists I was afraid of, not principally. It was his anger. We didn't do anger in my family. We did ironic comment, snappy rejoinder, satirical elaboration. We did exact words forbidding a certain action, and more severe ones condemning what had already taken place. But for anything beyond this, we did the thing enjoined upon the English middle classes for generations. We internalized our rage, our anger, our contempt. We spoke words under our breath. We might have written some of those words down in private diaries if we kept them. But we also thought that we were the only ones reacting like this, and it was a little shameful. So we internalized it all even further. When I got to my room that night, I placed a chair at an angle wedged under the doorknob as I'd seen done in films. I lay in bed thinking, is this what the adult world is really like? Underneath it all? And how close beneath the surface does it, will it, lie? I had no answers. I didn't tell Susan about either of these incidents. I internalized my anger and shame. Well, I would, wouldn't I? And you'll have to imagine long spells of happiness, of delight, of laughter. I've described them already. That's the thing about memory. It's... Well, let me put it like this. Have you ever seen an electric log splitter in action? They're very impressive. You cut the log to a certain length, lay it on the bed of the machine, press the button with your foot, and the log is pushed onto a blade shaped like an axe head, whereupon the log splits pure and straight down the grain. That's the point I'm trying to make. Life is a cross-section. Memory is a split down the grain, and memory follows it all the way to the end. So I can't not continue. Even if this is the hardest part to remember. No, not to remember. To describe. It was the moment when I lost some of my innocence. That may sound like a good thing. Isn't growing up a necessary process of losing one's innocence? Maybe. Maybe not. But the trouble with life is, you rarely know when that loss is going to happen, do you? And how it will be afterwards. My parents were away on holiday, and my granny, my mother's mother, had been drafted in to look after me. I was, of course, 20. Only 20, so obviously couldn't be left in the house by myself. What I might get up to, whom I might import, what I might organize, a bacchanalia of middle-aged women, perhaps, what might the neighbors think, and who might subsequently refuse to come for sherry. Grandma, widowed some 5 years, didn't have anything better to do. I had naturally, innocently, loved her as a child. Now I was growing up and she seemed boring. But that was a loss of innocence I could handle. At this time, I used to sleep quite late during the holidays. It could have been mere idleness or a belated reaction to the stress of the university term, or perhaps some instinctive unwillingness to re-enter this world I still called home. I would sleep on until 11 without compunction, and my parents, to their credit, never came in and sat on my bed and complained that I was treating the place like a hotel. While Grandma was happy to cook me breakfast at lunchtime if that's what I wanted. So it was probably closer to 11 than 10 when I stumbled downstairs.
"There's a very rude woman asking for you," said Grandma. "She's rung 3 times. She told me to wake you up. Actually, the last time to be wake you up. I said I'm not interfering with his beauty sleep."
"Good for you, Grandma. Thanks." A very rude woman. But I didn't know anyone. Someone from the tennis club persecuting me further? The bank about my overdraft? Maybe Grandma was beginning to lose her marbles, at which point the phone went again.
"Joan,"
said the very rude voice of Joan.
"It's Susan. Get over there. She wants you, not me. You. Now."
And she put the phone down.
"Aren't you having your breakfast?"
asked Grandma as I rushed out. At the MacLeods, the front door was open, and I walked around until I found her fully dressed, handbag beside her, on the sofa in the sitting room. She didn't look up when I greeted her. I could only see the top of her head, or rather,
the curve of her headscarf. I sat down beside her, but she immediately turned her face away.
I need you to drive me up to town.
Of course, darling.
And I need you not to ask me any questions and absolutely not to look at me.
Whatever you say, but you'll need to tell me roughly where we're going.
Head for Selfridges.
Are we in a hurry? I allowed myself that question.
Just drive safely, Paul.
Just drive safely. We got near Selfridges and she directed me down Wigmore Street, then left up one of those streets where private doctors practice.
Park here.
Do you want me to come with you?
I'd rather not. Get yourself some lunch. This won't be quick. Do you need some money?
I had, indeed, come without my wallet. She gave me a 10-shilling note. As I turned back into Wigmore Street, I saw ahead of me John Bell and Croydon, where she had gone for her Dutch cap. A terrible realization came upon me. That the system had failed, that she'd found herself pregnant, and was even now dealing with the consequences. The abortion law was still going through Parliament, but everyone knew there were doctors, and not just the backstreet end, who would perform procedures, more or less on demand. I imagined the conversation. Susan explaining how she had got herself pregnant by her young lover, hadn't had sex with her husband for 2 decades, and how a child would destroy her marriage and endanger her own mental health. That would be enough for any doctor who would agree to what went down euphemistically in medical records as a DNC, dilation and curettage, just a little scraping away at the lining of the womb, which would also scrape away the embryo attached to its wall. I was working all this out as I sat in an Italian cafe having my lunch. I didn't know what I thought, or rather, I thought several incompatible things. The notion of being a father while still a student struck me as terrifying and crazy. But it also struck me as, well, kind of heroic. Subversive yet honourable, annoying yet life-affirming, noble. I didn't think it would get me into the Guinness Book of Records. No doubt there were 12-year-olds hard at work getting their granny's best friends pregnant, but it would certainly make me exceptional and irritate the hell out of the village. Except that now it wasn't going to happen, because Susan was getting rid of our child at this very moment, just around the corner. I felt a sudden rage. A woman's right to choose, yes. I believed in that, theoretically and actually. Though I also believed in a man's right to be consulted. I went back to the car and waited. After an hour or so, she turned the corner and came towards me, head lowered, scarf pulled around her cheeks. She averted her face from me as she got into the car.
Right,
she said.
That's that for the moment.
There was something slurry about her articulation. The anaesthetic, presumably, if they used any.
Home, James, and don't spare the horses.
Normally I was charmed by her turns of phrase. Not this time.
First, tell me where you've been.
The dentist. The dentist. So much for my imaginings. Unless this was just another euphemism among women of Susan's class.
I'll tell you when I can, Casey Paul. I can't tell you now. Don't ask.
Of course not. I drove her home as carefully as I could. Over the next days, she told me bit by bit what had happened. She had been sitting up late, listening to the gramophone. MacLeod had gone to bed an hour previously. She kept playing over and over again the slow movement of Prokofiev's 3rd piano concerto, which we'd heard a few days before at the festival hall. Then she put the record back in its sleeve and went upstairs. She was just reaching for the handle of her bedroom door when her hair was seized from behind, and with the words,
"How's your fucking musical education coming along?"
her husband smashed her face into the closed door. Then he had gone back to bed. The dentist's examination showed that her 2 front teeth were broken beyond repair. The 2 teeth on either side of them would probably have to go as well. There was a crack in her upper jaw, which would, over time, heal itself. The dentist would make her a plate. He asked her if she wanted to talk about how it had happened, but didn't press her when she said she would rather not. As the bruising came up in all its furious colours, and she powdered over it as well as she could, as I drove her up to town and back for appointment after appointment, as I wasn't able to get her to look at me for days or kiss me for weeks, as I realized I would never again be able to tap her rabbit teeth, long discarded in some Wimpole Street waste bin, as I understood that I now had greater responsibilities than before, as I found myself wondering, and not idly, how I might kill Gordon MacLeod. As first my grandma and then my returning parents drove me mad with their careful, safe, banal views of life. As Susan's bravery and lack of self-pity nearly broke my heart. As I absented myself from her house a good hour before MacLeod's daily return. As I accepted her word. Or was it his word? That nothing like this would ever happen again. As anger and pity and horror washed through me, as I realized that Susan would have to leave the bastard somehow, with me or without me, but obviously with me. As at the same time a kind of impotence overcame me, as all this was happening, I learned a little more about the MacLeod marriage. Of course, that bruise on her upper arm had not just been the size of a thumbprint, it was the imprint of an actual thumb, as he forced her to sit in the chair and listen to his denunciations. There had been grabbings and slappings, and more than a punch or two. He would put a glass of sherry down in front of her and order her to
join in the fun.
When she declined, he would grasp her by the hair, pull her head back, and hold the glass to her lips. Either she drank, or he poured it down her chin and throat and dress. It was all verbal and physical, never sexual. Though, whether there was anything sexual behind it, well, that is beyond my competence, or indeed, interest. Yes, it was usually connected to his drinking, but not necessarily. Yes, she was frightened of him, except that mostly she wasn't. She had learned to manage him over the years. Yes, every time he attacked her, it was of course her fault, according to him. She drove him to it with her airy bloody insolence. That had been one of his phrases. Also, her irresponsibility, also her stupidity. At some point after he had smashed her face against the door, he had gone downstairs and bent Prokofiev's third piano concerto until the record broke. It was, I suppose, ignorance and snobbery on my part which had hitherto made me assume that domestic violence was confined to the lower classes, where things were done differently, where, as I understood from my reading rather than from a close familiarity with backstreet life, women would rather their husbands hit them than be unfaithful to them. If he beats you, it shows he loves you, and all that crap. The idea of violence being inflicted by husbands with a Cambridge degree seemed to me incomprehensible. Of course, it was not a matter I'd had reason to think about before, but if I had, I would probably have guessed that violence among working-class husbands was connected to inarticulacy. They fell back on their fists, whereas middle-class husbands fell back on words. Both these myths took some years to dispel, despite the present evidence. Susan's dental plate caused her constant trouble. There were many drives up to town for adjustments. The dentist had also made 4 new prosthetic teeth, better aligned than the original ones, and shortened the central pair by a millimeter or two. A subtle change, but one always manifest to me. Those teeth I used to tap so lovingly were gone forever, and I had no desire to touch their replacements. One thing I never swerved from was the certainty that Gordon MacLeod's behaviour was a crime of absolute liability, and his responsibility was also absolute. A man hits a woman. A husband hits a wife. A drunkard hits a sober spouse. There was no defence. No possible mitigation. The fact that it would never come to court, that middle-class England had a thousand ways of avoiding the truth, that respectability was no more shed in public than clothes, the fact that Susan would never accuse him to any authority, not even a dentist, all this had no relevance to me, except sociologically. The man was as guilty as hell, and I would hate him until the end of his days. This much I knew. It was about a year after this that I went to see Joan and announced our intention of moving up to London. You are an absolutist for love, and therefore an absolutist against marriage. You have given the matter much thought and come up with many fanciful comparisons. Marriage is a dog kennel in which complacency lives and is never chained up. Marriage is a jewelry box which, by some mysterious opposite of alchemy, turns gold, silver, and diamonds back into base metal, paste, and quartz. Marriage is a disused boathouse containing an old, two-person canoe, no longer waterworthy, with holes in the bottom and one missing paddle. Marriage is... Oh, you have dozens of such comparisons to hand. You remember your parents and your parents' friends. They were, on the whole, and without giving them too much credit, decent people. Honest, hard-working, polite with one another. No more than averagely controlling of their children. Family life meant for them what it had meant for their parents' generation, though with just enough extra social freedom to let them imagine themselves pioneers. But where was love in all of this, you asked. And you didn't even mean sex, because you preferred not to think about that. And so, when you had come into the MacLeod household and inspected a different way of living, you thought first about how circumscribed your own home seemed to be, how lacking in life and emotion. Then, gradually, you realized that the marriage of Gordon and Susan MacLeod was actually in far worse shape than any marriage among your parents' circle, and you became all the more absolutist. That Susan should live with you in a state of love was obvious. That she should leave MacLeod was equally obvious. That she should divorce him, especially after what he had done to her, seemed not just an acknowledgement of the truth of things, not just a romantic obligation, but a necessary first step towards her becoming an authentic person once more. No, not once more. Really, it would be for the first time. And how exciting must that be for her? You persuade her to see a solicitor. No, she doesn't want you to come with her. Part of you, the part that imagines a free and freestanding Susan in the near future, approves. How did it go?
He said that I was in a bit of a muddle.
He said that?
No, not exactly, but I explained things to him. Most things. Not you, obviously. And, well, I suppose he thought I'd just bolted, done a bunk. Maybe he thought it was all to do with the dreaded.
But didn't you explain what had happened? What he did to you?
I didn't go into detail, no. I kept it general.
But you can't get a divorce on general grounds. You can only get a divorce on particular grounds.
Now don't get shirty with me, Paul. I'm doing my best.
Yes, but
he told me that, for a starting point, I should go away and write it all down, because he could see I found it hard to tell him about it directly.
That sounds very sensible. Suddenly you approve of this solicitor.
So that's what I shall try to do.
When, a couple of weeks later, you ask how her statement is coming along, she shakes her head without replying.
But you've got to do it,
you say.
You don't know how hard it is for me.
Would you like me to help you?
No, I have to do this by myself.
You approve. This will be the start, the making, of the new Susan. You try some gentle advice. I think what they need are specifics. You know a bit about divorce law by now. Exactly what happened and roughly when. Another 2 weeks later, you ask how she's doing.
Don't give up on me just yet, Casey Paul,
is her reply. And whenever she says this to you, and you never think it is calculated because she is not a calculating person, it tears at your heart. Of course you won't give up on her. And then, some weeks later, she gives you a few sheets of paper.
Don't read it in front of me.
You take it away, and from the first sentence your optimism disperses. She has turned her life and her marriage into a comic short story, which sounds to you like something by James Thurber. Perhaps it was. It is about a man in a three-piece suit called Mr. Elephant Pants, who every evening goes to the pub or to the bar at Grand Central Station. He comes home in a state which alarms his wife and children. He knocks over the hat stand, kicks the flower pots, shouts at the dog, so that there is a spreading of great alarm and despondency. And he rackets away until he falls asleep on the sofa and snores so loudly that the tiles fall off the roof. You don't know what to say. You say nothing. You pretend you are still considering this document. You know that you have to be very gentle and very patient with her. You explain again about them needing to know specifics, the where and the when and, most importantly, the what. She looks at you and nods. Slowly, over the next weeks and months, you begin to understand that it is not going to happen. Not ever. She is strong enough to love you, strong enough to run off with you, but not strong enough to enter a court of law and give evidence against her husband about the decades of sexless tyranny, alcoholism, and physical attack. She will not be able, even via her solicitor, to ask the dentist to describe her injuries. She cannot attest in public to what she is able to admit in private. You realize that, even if she is the free spirit you imagined her to be, she is also a damaged free spirit. You understand that there is a question of shame at the bottom of it. Personal shame and social shame. She may not mind being thrown out of the tennis club for being a Scarlet Woman, but she cannot admit to the true nature of her marriage. You remember old cases in which criminals, even murderers, would marry their female accomplices because a wife could not be compelled to give evidence against her husband. But nowadays, far away from the world of criminality, in the respectable village and many, many similar, silent places across the land, there are wives who have been conditioned by social and marital convention not to give evidence against their husbands. And there is another factor, of which, strangely, you have not thought. One calm evening, calm because you have officially given up on the project and all false hope and annoyance have drained from you, she says to you quietly, "And anyway, if I did do it, he'd bring up the matter of you." You are astounded. You feel you had nothing to do with the breakup of the MacLeod marriage. You were just the outsider who pointed out what would have been obvious to anyone. Yes, you fell in love with her. Yes, you ran away with her. But that was consequence, not cause. Even so, perhaps you are lucky that the old law of enticement is no longer on the statute book. You imagine being called as a witness and asked to explain yourself. Part of you thinks this would be wonderful, heroic. You play through the courtroom exchange, in which you are dazzling. Until the final question. Oh, and by the way, young enticer, young seducer, may I ask what you do by way of a job? Of course, you reply. I'm studying to be a solicitor. You realize that you might just have to change profession. You know that sometimes, after checking on the house she owns half of, she goes to visit Joan. This is a good idea, even if, on her return, her hair smells of cigarette smoke. Once you catch sherry on her breath. Did you have a drink with Joan?
Did I? Let me think. Quite possibly.
Well, you shouldn't. Drink and drive. It's crazy.
Yes, sir,
she agrees satirically. Another time, she has smoke in her hair and polos on her breath. You think, this is silly. Look, if you're going to have a drink with Joan, don't insult my intelligence by chewing a few polos afterwards.
The thing is, Paul, there are parts of the drive I don't like. They give me the jitters, blind corners. I find that a little nip of sherry with Joan calms my nerves. And the polos aren't for you, darling. They're in case I get stopped by a policeman.
I'm sure policemen are just as suspicious of drivers smelling of polos as when they smell of alcohol.
Don't you turn into a policeman, Paul. Or a lawyer, even if you are going to be one. I'm doing my best. That's all I can do.
Of course. You kiss her. You have no more taste for confrontation than she does. Of course you trust her. Of course you love her. Of course you are far too young to be a policeman or a lawyer. And so you both laugh your way through several uncomplicated months. But one February afternoon, she is late back from the village. You know she doesn't like driving in the dark. You imagine the car off the road, in a ditch, her bloodied head against the dashboard, polo spinning from her handbag. You ring Joan. I'm a bit worried about Susan.
Why?
Well, what time did she leave you?
When?
Today.
I haven't seen Susan today.
Joan's voice is steady.
I wasn't expecting her either.
Oh, fuck.
you say.
Let me know when she's back safely.
Sure, you say, your mind only half there.
And Paul?
Yes.
If she comes back safely, that's the main thing.
Yes. It is the main thing, and she does come back safely, and her hair is clean, and there is nothing on her breath.
Sorry I'm late, darling,
she says, putting down her handbag.
Yes, I was worrying. No need to worry.
Well, I do. You leave it after that. After supper, you pick up the plates and, making sure your back is to her, ask, How's old Joan?
Joan? Same as ever. Joan doesn't change. That's what's nice about her.
You rinse off the plates and leave it at that. You are a lover, not a lawyer, you remind yourself. Except that you are going to become a lawyer, because you need to be solid and stable, the better to look after her. The log of memory splits down the grain, so you can't remember the quiet times, the outings, the jollity, the running jokes, even the legal studies, which fill the gap between that last exchange and the day when, worried by a succession of late returns from the village, you say to her, quietly and unchallengingly, I know you don't always go and see Joan when you say you do. She looks away.
Have you been checking up on me, Casey Paul? It's a terrible, unloving thing to do, check up on people.
Yes, but I can't stop worrying, and I can't bear to think of you alone in the house with him.
Oh, I'm quite safe,
she says. There is silence for a while.
Look, Paul, I don't tell you about it because I don't want the two parts of my life overlapping. I want to build a wall around us here. But there are practical matters to discuss with him.
Like divorce. Immediately you feel ashamed of your sarcasm.
Don't badger me like that, Mr. Badger. I've got to do things in my own time. It's all more complicated than you think.
Okay.
He and I have two children together. Don't forget that.
I don't, though of course you do, often.
There's money to discuss. The car, the house. I think the place needs repainting this summer.
You discuss painting the house.
That's enough from you, Mr. Badger.
Okay, you say. But you love me, and you don't love him.
You know that's how it is, Casey Paul. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't.
And I suppose he would like you to return.
What I hate,
she says,
is when he gets down on his knees.
He gets down on his knees. In his elephant pants, I think.
Yes, it's awful. It's embarrassing. It's undignified.
And what? Begs you to stay with him?
Yes. You see why I don't tell you about it?
The fancy boys used to turn up at Henry Road and sleep on the floor, tossing like dogs on piles of cushions. The more of them there were, the more busily relaxed Susan became. So this was all good. Sometimes they brought their girlfriends, whose reaction to Henry Road used to intrigue me. I became expert in sensing covert disapproval. I wasn't being defensive or paranoid, merely observant. Also, I was amused by the orthodoxy of their sexual outlook. You might have thought, mightn't you, that a girl or young woman in her early 20s would be rather encouraged by the notion that something exciting might happen to her nearly 3 decades on. That her heart and body would still be excitable, and that her future didn't necessarily have to be a matter of rising social acceptance combined with slow emotional diminution. I was surprised that some of them didn't find my relationship with Susan a cause for cheer. Instead, they reacted much as their parents would have done, alarmed, threatened, moralistic. Perhaps they were looking forward to being mothers themselves, and imagining their precious sons being cradle-snatched. Anyone would have thought Susan was a witch who had entranced me, fit only for the ducking stool. Well, she had entranced me. And to feel the disapproval from women of my own age merely increased my pleasure at Susan's and my originality, and my own determination to continue offending the prim and the unimaginative. Well, we all have to have a purpose in life, don't we?
just as a young man needs a reputation. Around this time, one of the lodgers moved out, and Eric, having broken up with his moralistic, marriage-demanding girlfriend, took over the free room on the top floor. This brought a new dynamic to the house, perhaps even a better one. Eric thoroughly approved of our relationship and would be able to keep an eye on Susan when I couldn't. He was allowed to pay rent, which made it seem the more illogical that Susan wouldn't take any from me. But I knew how she would react if I renewed my offer. A few months passed. One evening, after Susan had gone to bed, Eric said, "Don't like to mention this." "Yes." He looked embarrassed, which was unlike Eric. "But the thing is, Susan's been nicking my whiskey." "Your whiskey? She doesn't even drink whiskey." "Well, it's her, or you, or the poltergeist." "You're sure?" I put a mark on the bottle. "How long's this been going on?"
"A few weeks, maybe months."
"Months? Why didn't you tell me?"
"Wanted to make sure."
"And she changed her tactics."
"How do you mean?"
"Well, at some point she must have noticed that there was a mark on the bottle. She'd have a nip or glug or however much it was, and then fill the bottle back up to the mark with water."
"That's clever."
"No, it's standard. Banal, even. My dad used to do that when Mum was trying to get him to stop."
"Oh."
I was disappointed. I wanted Susan always to be as entirely original as she still appeared to me. So I did the logical thing. I stopped drinking from the bottle myself. She'd come up, have a swig, fill up to the pencil mark with water. I let it run and run, until I could see the colour of the whiskey fading. Eventually, to confirm it, I had a glass myself. One part whiskey to about 15 of water would be my guess.
Fuck.
Yes, fuck. I'll have a word with her. I promised. But I didn't. Was it cowardice? The hope that some alternative explanation might present itself, or a weary refusal to admit my own suspicions? And in the meantime, I'll keep my booze on top of the wardrobe.
Good plan.
It was a good plan, until the day when Eric said quietly, "She's learnt to climb up to the top of the wardrobe." He made it sound like some kind of monkey trick rather than a normal piece of behaviour involving a chair, but that's how it felt to me, too. You notice there are times when she seems not squiffy, but out of focus. Not bleary of face, but bleary of mind. Then, by chance, you notice her swallowing a pill.
"Headache?"
"No," she replies. She is in one of those moods. Lucid, unself-pitying, yet somehow beaten down, which bend your heart painfully. She comes and sits on the edge of the bed.
"I went to the doctor. I explained what had happened. I explained that I'd been feeling depressed. He gave me some cheering-up pills."
"I'm sorry you need them. I must be letting you down."
"It's not you, Paul, and it's not fair on you either. But I think if I can get through the adjustment, then it'll get better."
"Did you tell him you were drinking a bit too much?"
"He didn't ask about that."
"That doesn't mean you shouldn't have told him."
"We're not going to quarrel about this, are we?"
"No, we're not going to quarrel. Ever."
"Then it'll all come out right. You'll see."
Thinking about this conversation later, you begin to understand, for the first time, really, that she has more to lose than you. Much more. You are leaving behind a past, much of which you are happy to let go. You believed, and still believe as deeply, that love is the only thing that counts, that it makes up for everything, that if you and she get it right, everything will fall into place. You realize that what she has left behind, even her relationship with Gordon MacLeod, is more complicated than you had assumed. You thought chunks could be cleanly amputated from a life without pain or complication. You realize that if she had seemed isolated in the village when you first met her, you have made her more isolated by taking her away. All this means that you must redouble your commitment to her. You must get through this tricky patch, and then things will become clearer, better. She believes that, and so you must believe it too. You take the back route as you approach the village to avoid passing your parents' house.
Where's Susan?
Are Joan's first words as she opens the door. I've come by myself.
Does she know?
You like the way Joan always gets straight to the point. You quite enjoy having cold water dashed in your face before sitting down with a streaky tumbler full of room-temperature gin. No.
Then it must be serious. I'll shut the little yappers up.
You sink into a dog-scented armchair and a drink is put next to you. As you are gathering your thoughts, Joan gets in first.
Point one. I'm not a go-between. Whatever you say stays in this room and doesn't get leaked back. Point two. I'm not a shrink. I'm not some kind of advice center. I don't even much like listening to other people's woes. I tend to think they should get on with it, stop moaning, roll up their sleeves and all of that.
Point three. I'm just an old soak whose life hasn't worked out and who lives alone with her dogs. So I'm not an authority on anything. Not even crosswords, as you once pointed out.
But you love Susan.
Of course I do. How is the dear girl?
She's drinking too much.
How much is too much?
In her case, anything at all.
You may be right.
And she's on antidepressants.
Well, we've all been there, says Joan. Doctors hand them out like Smarties, especially to women of a certain age. Do they do any good?
I can't tell. They just make her woozy, but a different kind of woozy from what the drink does.
Yes, I remember that too.
So?
So what?
So what should I do?
Poor dear, I just told you I don't give advice. I took my own advice for so many years, and look where it got me, so I don't do that anymore.
You nod. You aren't too surprised either.
The only advice I'd give you,
yes,
is have a swig of what's at your elbow.
You obey.
Okay,
you say.
No advice, but
I don't know.
Is there something that I ought to know and don't? Something you can tell me about Susan or about Susan and me that would help?
All I can say is that if everything goes belly up and pear-shaped, you'll probably get over it and she probably won't.
You are shocked.
That's not a very kind thing to say.
I don't do kind, Paul. Truth isn't kind.
You'll find that out soon enough as life kicks in. It feels as if it's kicked in pretty hard already.
That may be all to the fucking good.
Your face must look as if it's just taken a slap.
Come on, Paul. You didn't come all the way down here so that I'd give you a hug and tell you that there are fairies at the bottom of the garden.
True. Just tell me your thoughts on this. Susan goes back to see MacLeod every so often, probably more than she says.
Does that trouble you?
Mainly, in the sense that if he ever lays a finger on her again, I'm going to have to kill him.
She laughs.
Oh, I do so miss the melodrama of being young.
Don't patronize me, Joan.
I'm not patronizing you, Paul. Of course you do no such thing. But I admire you for the thought.
You wonder if she is being satirical. But Joan doesn't do satire.
Why don't you think I would?
Because the last murder in the village was probably committed by someone wearing woad.
You laugh and take another sip of gin.
I'm worried,
you say.
I'm worried that I shan't be able to save her.
She doesn't reply, and this annoys you.
So what do you think about that?
You demand.
I told you, I'm not a fucking oracle. You might as well read your horoscope in the Advertiser and Gazette. I said when you ran away together, you've got guts, the pair of you. You've got guts, and you've got love. If that isn't good enough for life, then life isn't good enough for you.
Now you are sounding like an oracle.
Then I'd better go and wash my mouth out with soap.
One day, you return to find her with cuts and bruises to her face, and her arms held defensively against her.
I fell over that step in the garden,
she says, as if it were a known hazard you had previously discussed.
I'm getting very trippy, I'm afraid.
She is indeed getting trippy. Nowadays, as a reflex, you take her arm as you walk with her and keep watch for uneven pavements.
but she also has a giveaway flush to her face. You call the doctor. Not the private one she went to for her cheering-up pills. Dr. Kenny is a fussy, inquisitive middle-aged man, but the right sort of GP. One who believes that house calls provide useful background when it comes to diagnosis. You take him upstairs to Susan's bedroom. Her bruises are coming into full colour. Downstairs again, he asks for a few words.
Of course. It's rather puzzling, he begins. It's unusual for a woman of her age to take a fall.
She's been getting very trippy lately.
Yes, that's the word she used to me. And if I may ask, you are...
I'm her lodger. No, more than that. Kind of godson, I suppose.
And it's just the two of you here.
There are two more lodgers in the attic rooms. You decide not to promote Eric to the status of second godson.
Does she have family?
Yes, but she's kind of estranged from them at the moment.
So she has no support? Except for you, that is.
I suppose not.
As I say, it's rather puzzling. Do you think there was drink involved?
Oh, no, you say swiftly. She doesn't drink. She hates the stuff. That's one of the reasons she left her husband. He's a drinker. Flagons and gallons, you add, without being able to stop yourself. You realize two things. First, that you lie automatically to protect Susan, even if the truth might have helped her more. You also begin to see how your relationship, or rather, your cohabitation, might appear to an outsider.
So, if I may ask, what does she do all day?
She does some volunteer work for the Samaritans? This isn't true either. Susan has mentioned the idea, though you're against it. You think she shouldn't try to start helping others when she is the one needing help.
That's not much, is it?
Well, I suppose she keeps house. He looks around. The place is clearly in a mess. You realize he is finding your answers inadequate, and why shouldn't he?
If it happens again, we'll be obliged to investigate, he says,
then picks up his bag and leaves. Investigate, you think. Investigate? He can tell you've been lying, but investigate what? Perhaps he guesses you are her lover and suspects that you might have been beating her up. Christ to that, you think. In your desire to protect her from being thought a drinker, you seem to be opening yourself up to a charge of assault. Perhaps he was giving you a final warning. Not that the police would necessarily be interested. You remember an incident from a year or two before. You are in the car with Susan and have scarcely gone a quarter of a mile when you notice a couple rowing on the pavement. As you see the man bearing down on the woman, you have flashbacks to the MacLeod household. He is not exactly hitting her, but looks about to do so. Maybe they are drunk. You can't tell. You wind down the window and the woman yells, "Call the police!" Now he is holding her. "Call the police!" You speed home, dial 999, and are picked up by a patrol car which takes you to the scene of the reported possible crime. The couple have moved on, but you soon track them down a couple of streets away. They are 10 yards apart, bellowing obscenities at one another.
"Oh, we know them," says the young constable. "It's just the domestic.
Aren't you going to arrest him?" The two of you are probably about the same age, but he knows he has seen more of life than you have.
"Well, sir, it's not our policy to interfere in domestics. I mean, not unless it really kicks off. They're just having a bit of a barney by the looks of it. Friday night, after all."
And then he drives the two of you home. You realize that you want official interference into other people's lives, but not into your own. You also realize that your truthfulness has become dangerously flexible, and you wonder if you should have got out of the car and tried to pull the man away from the woman. One of your problems is this. For a long time, it remains inconceivable to you that she is a drinker. How could she be, given that her husband is a drinker and drink disgusts her? She hates even the smell of it, as she hates the bogus emotions it sets off in people. It makes MacLeod coarser, angrier, more crudely sentimental. When he grabbed her hair and forced a glass to her lips, she would rather the sherry went down her dress than her throat. nor has anyone in her life ever offered a credible counterexample. Alcohol as glamorous, as usefully disinhibiting, as fun, as something you can control, knowing when to give the stuff its hour and when to refuse it. You believe her. You never query her increasing lapses and lateness. When you come in to find her blank-faced and bleary, you tell yourself that she has mistakenly swallowed an extra cheering-up pill, which is sometimes the case. And because you inevitably believe that one of the reasons she is on antidepressants is because you are failing to make her so happy that she doesn't need them, you feel guilty. And this guilt forbids you from questioning her. So when, out of her bleariness, she looks up, pats the sofa beside her, and asks, "Where have you been all my life?" you feel a ripping and a tearing inside you. There is nothing you want more in the world than to make everything all right for her, and on her own terms, not yours. So you sit down next to her and take her wrists. Just as you believe your love to be unique, you believe your problems, her problems, to be unique. You are too young to understand that all human behavior falls into patterns and categories, and that your case is far from unique. You want her to be some kind of exception, rather than any kind of rule. If anyone had ventured such a word as codependency to you back then, assuming the term had even been invented, you would have laughed it off as American jargon. However, you might have been more impressed by a statistical linkage of which you were then unaware, that the partners of alcoholics, far from being repulsed by the habit, or rather, despite being repulsed by the habit, frequently succumb to it themselves. But the next stage for you is to accept a percentage of the evidence in front of your eyes. You understand that in certain, very limited circumstances, she needs the small lift of a small drink, as she now occasionally admits. Obviously, she has to keep Joan company when she goes to the village. Obviously, she's sometimes frightened by the increasing traffic on the roads and by that sudden twisty climb over the hills, so a little nip helps her. Obviously, she is sometimes very lonely when you're away at college for most of the day. She also has my bad time, as she calls it, usually between 5 and 6 in the evening, though as the days draw in and dusk falls earlier, so her bad time, accordingly, starts earlier, and, obviously, extends just as late as it did before. You believe what she says. You believe that the bottle she keeps beneath the sink, behind the bleach and the washing-up liquid and silver polish, is the only bottle she drinks from. When she suggests that you put a pencil mark on the bottle so you can both monitor how much she drinks, you are heartened, and think these pencil marks are quite different from the ones on Eric's whiskey bottle. Nor do you imagine there are other bottles elsewhere. When friends try to tip you off, "I'm a bit worried about Susan's drinking," says one, and, "Boy, you could smell the booze from the other end of the phone," says another. You react in various ways. You protect her by denying it. You admit there are occasional lapses. You say the two of you have talked about it and she has promised to see someone. You may even say all three things in the course of a single conversation. But you will also be offended by your friend's attempted helpfulness. Because you do not need help. The two of you, since you love one another, will be able to sort the matter out, thank you very much. And this slightly alienates your friends, and also alienates them from her. Increasingly, you find yourself saying, "She was just having a bad day." And you believe it yourself by dint of repetition. Because there are still many good hours, and good days, when sobriety and cheerfulness fill the house, and her eyes and smile are just as they were when you first met. And you do something simple like drive for a walk in the woods, or go to the cinema and hold hands, and a sudden rush of feeling tells you it is all very easy and straightforward. And then your love is reaffirmed. Yours for her, hers for you. And you wish you could display her to your friends at times like this. Look, she is still herself, not just underneath, but here. Now, on the surface too. You never suspect that one reason your friends tend to see her half-cut might be because she has persuaded herself, by some tortuous argument, that she needs a little Dutch courage before facing them. Each stage rolled seamlessly into the next. And here comes a paradoxical one that you initially struggle with. If you love her, as you unwaveringly do, and if loving